The noise has subsided enough that we can hear each other speak. So, Mobler, you're here. It's on. All right. We're going to ask House Research to give us some guidance here. We were going to work on Bowser and then PCA, where there are substantial differences in language. And since we don't have targets yet, we can work on those two things. And then as we get that done, we can work on the differences in agriculture. So that's kind of where we're mapping out here. So if I think one of the things we had talked about is looking at the Bowser language, and we were going to hear testimony from Bowser on various things, including, I think, the Minnesota River Board and some other things like that. So I think Bowser will know what's outstanding there, and let's just start there. And how the council could remind us what page we would be on to do that.
Madam Chair and members, for the fiscal part, it would be in Article 3 on the House side and Article 1 on the Senate side. It'd be on R31. That's where those Bowser appropriations start. And then there's only one policy section that's exclusively Bowser related. And I can point that out later.
Maybe we should start with that Bowser policy provision that is different, since there's only one of them, and that is where the Senate has language where the House does not. Could you remind us of the page of that?
Sure, that would be R83, and that's in Article 4 on the House side, Article 2 on the Senate. And that's the discontinuance of the Hennepin Soil Water Conservation District.
Mr. Jaski, if you would like to address that, since this is language that the Senate has, the House does not have.
Madam Chair, members, yes, on page R83 of the side-by-side, beginning on line 73.32, this language is a reflection of an agreement that has been worked out for about a year between Hennepin County and the agency. This case, the Soil and Water Conservation District, authorities would continue to exist. They would be carried out by the county board as long as or until they no longer elect to do that, and then the Hennepin County Soil and Water Conservation District would be reinstated if the Hennepin County Board chose not to carry out those duties. And there's a long and unique history here with this situation, hence the reflection of its inclusion in a specific part of statute that is only applicable to Hennepin County. And I think that's, Madam Chair, the summary of how this came to be in the Senate bill.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Jaski, so elsewhere we provide cost share to go to soil and water districts. Would cost share that goes out to the districts for general services or for competitive grants, would then Hennepin County be the entity that would receive those or apply for those?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, potentially yes. There's a couple of things I should just point out in this legislation that would have to occur. One is that the legislation still would require findings and decision by the Board of Water and Soil Resources that the discontinuance would take effect based on a report that we have has been developed and probably some additional findings. And if that findings were acted on by the board and the discontinuance moved forward, then Hennepin County would be eligible to receive those grants and carry out the programs as if they were a soil and water conservation district.
Madam Chair, Mr. Jaski, what's kind of the timeline on this? Would this be occurring in the current fiscal year, or would it be likely to occur shortly after the beginning of the new fiscal year in terms of the discontinuance and or appropriation of money? My reason for asking that is, you know, we go over July 1 and then the Hennepin Conservation District gets an allocation and then maybe discontinued. Just how would that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, the discontinuance would be initiated by a petition from the county, so we would have to wait for that. Presuming that they acted on that, in due haste, I guess we would likely be able to make the grant to Hennepin County at this coming fiscal year. We could, if necessary, delay this one particular payment to this one particular county, anticipating that they would be coming.
Madam Chair, could I just, I think what I can get what Representative Hanson is trying to, if you look on page R84, you can see the transfer of assets. So if this were to happen after the beginning of the fiscal year and the Soil and Water Conservation District received grants, all of those assets are transferred to the board. And you can also see in subdivision 5 that if it's discontinued, that the that now the Hennepin County would be eligible to receive the Soil and Water Conservation grants directly from the board.
Madam Chair, I would move approval of Section 83 in the Senate language relating to the Hennepin Conservation.
See, no further discussion. All those in favor of Representative Hansen's motion to accept Section 83 of the Senate language, say aye.
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 Opposition? It's been adopted. We can go now from there to fiscal plugs. See, got work done.
Job.
So. And what do we have a page here?
It'd be on R31.
Of Article 4?
Pardon?
Article 4?
3. Obviously, we can't adopt anything that has money in it, but we can discuss some of the differences, and you are going to bring us more information.
Madam Chair, I guess since I think staff have walked you through the comparisons previously, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things that I know came up at the prior discussion on this topic. I think I would begin with that on well, we can either talk about the cost if you want to, but the things that I was specifically going to talk about was the Minnesota River Board and the Area 2, those local organizations that had some question marks. And so let me start with the Minnesota River Board, which would be on the Senate side on line 22.3 on page R33. The Senate position includes $42,000 per year to the Minnesota River Board, which reflects the governor's recommendation. Currently, the Minnesota River Board is going through what I would call a self-assessment. They would have had this done this year, but for the fact that at two of their meetings, they ended up encountering major snowstorms and had to postpone those. And so they're about a month behind, I guess. But the work to date has them changing themselves or transforming themselves from a statutory authority, which requires them to be a joint powers of county boards, or allows them to be, it doesn't say requires them to be, to something that has more inclusion than simply the counties. I wouldn't want to go much further than that because I have not been part of their discussions and they're making those decisions for themselves. They have currently and in the past been using the Minnesota State University Water Resources Center as both their administrative agent and their technical resource expertise. And they've hired, for this one project, a consultant who's more of an organizational assessment consultant to help them. So, I mean, I'm sure I can tell you that's where it's at. I can also, I have a summary here of the county contributions, the local contributions that would be used to match the state dollars from the past year, and presumably that would be the amount that would continue forward. So if someone could grab these, I guess I'll...
Point, if they have no structure, they're still talking about a structure to adopt. Will they have authority to raise money with the new structure? It didn't appear to me that they would, but maybe I was missing that.
Madam Chair, they would have no new authority to raise local revenue. What they've been doing is each of the member counties have assessed themselves, you know, or found their own revenue through levy or other sources to contribute, in this case, $35,000 for fiscal year 13. That would be the local component of their operations. You know, I think that they are created in statute, but the statute doesn't give them any new or unique revenue collection authority.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I understand and appreciate what the board has done. However, I think the question is whether the state continues to fund it. And $42,000, if you divide that by the 16 or 17 counties, I think it's important, if the counties truly want to participate in this, that they pony up the money to provide for the administration. This appropriation has been reduced over the last few biennium. I think we've talked a lot, at least in the House, about outcomes. And to me, the outcome is this board has struggled. It's existed, but it's struggled. And it's just because things exist doesn't mean they have to continue to exist. So I think it's the House is a better approach by taking the limited amount of dollars there and putting them into the cost share program for projects rather than continuing to have state investment at this time into this board until we see the counties all want to contribute and continue to make it happen.
Madam Chair, I know you're not going to be able to make a decision on this today, as you described. You know, just to throw out some other, possible options. I mean, they are in the middle of this, and so I guess that's the point that I want to make is they haven't made a conclusion yet. If they do not exist, if they choose not to exist, of course the money would not be granted to them, and so then it would need to be some language about where it would be redirected to would be helpful to the agency if in fact they choose not to. Go forward with their current joint powers agreement. As I mentioned, Minnesota State Mankato is the agent that does the bulk of their scientific work and a little bit of their administrative work. And, you know, another way to do it would be to consider having them be a direct party to this agreement rather than the joint powers board, because it wouldn't be in existence potentially if they decide to disband. So just a couple different administrative thoughts for you to consider.
I think the bigger question is, if they are a board with a structure, to do what? I mean, that has been kind of the basic question. Not.
Madam Chair, I've said the exact same thing to them as bluntly as I could on two occasions. I went to their meetings and said the very same thing, and that got them to the point of this self-assessment, I guess. And Representative Hansen mentioned the county dues, and actually there's the number of counties is actually over 30 that are part of the Minnesota River Basin, and so it's a small contribution that they're making, when you add it all up. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not doing things in the Minnesota River as individual counties. It just means that as this joint powers authority, this is a limited amount of contribution that they're putting forward for that. So I want to make sure we don't connect those two points.
Any other questions?
So we're not really quibbling over the $42,000. We're really quibbling over whether or not we should even pay the expenses. Is that it?
Well, it's more of what do we get for the money? I think that's the question. Not that the board isn't a good idea, but they have not. What is it they're going to do with the money?
They make reports of the projects already?
Oh, yeah.
Would they make them anyway without the money?
Yeah.
Well, the projects are done by the counties or the watersheds down there, right?
Madam Chair, those local organizations, the Soil Water Conservation District, counties, and water districts are all doing good work. This is a special authority that was created back in, I think, the mid-1990s in statute. The Minnesota legislature passed a bill that created this entity, and I think it was amended a couple of years ago to just update a few things. And they formed this Joint Powers Authority, but I would concur with your conclusions about their accomplishments, let's put it that way, as a Joint Powers Authority, not as a group of other organizations. And so it's really, you know, sort of determining whether they could be successful in the future or not. And at this point, we just don't know, because they are in a they're in the middle of figuring out if they can be or don't want to be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question, perhaps, maybe to go back in history a little bit, is, you know, this is obviously a creation of the legislature. Why did the legislature create it in the first place? I mean, that should be part of the driving discussion of, you know, what the mission is. If they come up with a mission statement that's substantially different than the purpose in which they were enacted in statute, I mean, that also kind of raises the question whether or not this warrants continued funding or even its existence. So I don't know if Mr. Jasky has some historical perspective he'd offer to the committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, yes, I think you're right about the fact that the policy language ought to be evaluated probably at the same time, or at least to be fair to them, you know, what was the purpose of this statute to create them in the first place? As has been stated before, their support for the thing that they were created to do is what I think is in question, because they have not, you know, the membership of the counties that are there has dwindled. The contributions that they've put to the effort has not increased. And the results that they, as a Joint Powers Authority, have accomplished have been, you know, hard to see unless you account for the things that Minnesota State University Mankato, the Water Resources Center, has done, and to some extent with their endorsement, I guess. But that's separating out those components is a little bit about what this is about.
If they're not, can they make a case?
Theoretically, I think it's a great idea. But yeah, whether we appropriate money to a theory or not, I think, is the question. Theoretically, if they could get their act together, they could really accomplish something. But that's not been there. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, but as it's written, it is about paying for the expenses to measure and report the results. And so if I'm understanding correctly, it's looking at how, I mean, whether or not we do it at all, but also if we do it, how would we do it? So currently it's going to the Joint Powers Board. It's not going directly to the State University. Is that correct?
Correct.
And is there an accounting of what expenses and how they're using those dollars?
Madam Chair, Representative Poppy, they do provide an annual report. I did not bring that with me because, of course, you know, quite a few pages. But Minnesota State University of Mankato does all of that work, you know, under the auspices of this Joint Powers Board, I guess is the way to describe it. Could they do that without that Joint Powers Board? In my opinion, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is this something that, even though we're not exactly sure what they've been doing to this point, is it something that's been requested by you, or is it something that you would are seeking to have done, or is this something? Is this part of what they came up with and decided they should do?
Madam Chair, Representative Poppy, this was in the governor's recommendation because we anticipated that they would have made a conclusion by now as to whether they were going to move forward in a new way or disband. And at that point, we wouldn't be able to say, you know, if the money will be useful or it won't be needed at all. Unfortunately, because of the timing with the weather events, they're not concluding that process, and therefore we're in this kind of no man's land, I guess, about what they will be doing.
Can I just ask one final question? Thank you, Madam Chair. So as far as the dollars that have been spent so far, or how are those, how are they allocated? Are they allocated just once a year, or is it as quarterly, or as expenses come in, or how is that done?
Madam Chair, Representative Poppe, it's been typically allocated in on an annual grant basis, so once a year.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, is there anyone here from the Association of Saltwater Conservation District?
Madam Chair, members, Sheila Vanney, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts.
Madam Chair and Ms. Vianney, would it, the Soil and Water Districts, I don't know if you have a policy position on this, or maybe you do, rather have more money going to Soil and Water Conservation Districts or to a Joint Powers Board Association of Counties?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's an interesting question. I guess the way that I'll answer it is that we do not have an official position on this particular Joint Powers Board. We will use whatever project dollars you send to the SWCDs in the best way that we can.
Madam Chair, very diplomatic and excellent answer.
I was going to tell her she didn't have to answer it, but she did it on her own. So.
Okay, I think that is kind of enough on that. We have a couple additional issues here. One is the Area 2, mm-hmm. that was one of the things. There's some language, and then there's the whole position that the House took on grants to local units of government to transition to water management plans. That's something we want to talk about, and the evaluating performance. I think that would kind of get us where we need to be, if you want to talk about those three things.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll start with the Area 2, just going in order of the bill. On page R33, on line 70.17 on the House side and 21.34 on the Senate side. What I passed around to you was a summary compiled by the Area 2 Flood Control Joint Powers Authority in southwestern Minnesota. They, again, are a joint powers authority created in state statute. In this case, so they've been quite effective in doing a flood damage program, both using local money, they've used state bonding money, and they use the state general fund appropriation to carry out that work. And it's a regional authority. You can see here in the table the amount of funding that's come from the state from local sources. And they, as a group of counties, do have a dedicated contribution each year to both the operations and then the projects, because they built these flood control projects in various places, and they have to maintain and manage those over time. So. And then the language, Madam Chair, that is in the House side, you know, would be not possible to do without some further either statutory language or time, because certainly the way a watershed district is formed starts with a petition from those that have the authority to seek that, and a process under Minnesota Statute 103D to hold hearings and take testimony and ultimately make a decision about whether a new watershed district would be formed or if an existing watershed would be expanded or boundaries were to be changed. One of the challenges with this language, would just in a practical way, would be that we already have some watershed districts in parts of this joint powers area, and so you'd have to figure out how to work with what we already have as well. So I think that language, as simple as it looks, would be very difficult to implement.
Well, I think a more basic question is the state has already put a lot of money in here. They've put a lot of money. When is this project going to be completed, and how much more money are we looking at? I mean, what's the big picture here?
Madam Chair, that information I will have to go back and get more on. I will say this, that they, you know, this area has some, you know, the Perfect Toll, you know, the highest topography you see out there, and a lot of other areas where we have water that moves across watershed boundaries. It's very unpredictable. They've done a lot of work with local road authorities to try and do retention projects in conjunction with public road upgrades. I will have to get you sort of their capital improvement program that probably it looks, you know, 10 years out of the projects you're still looking to do, and maybe give you some better sense of the total solution that is going to be needed there.
We're working without a context here, from my point of view. Does other members feel the same way, or Representative Hansen?
Madam Chair and Mr. Jashke, I think this is kind of the similar question. What's the state purpose for funding this? And the purpose can't be just because we've always done it. My understanding, it's 40 or 50 years of always doing it. And when I look at the sheet that you have here, where the state funds are providing a greater amount of the general administrative cost than the local funds, there's a question of comparison. If we look at the metro area with watershed management organizations, they're fulfilling a similar role that they tax themselves to pay for these tasks. They're not getting statewide dollars in an appropriation, a line item appropriation or an earmark like Area 2 has. And we can look elsewhere around the state. I think what we were trying to do with the language about transition to a watershed district is recognizing that this has existed, but elsewhere around the state, they have watershed districts or they have regional work that's being done, and the locals have to make the decision whether they want to do it, and they have to fund it. Area 2, and I can remember previous conference committees where we've talked about this. This is an appropriation of state dollars that keeps coming into there. So we cut it in half the second year and apply that money to projects. And we say we should transition to a watershed district. If the Joint Powers Board, as it exists, the counties within that Joint Powers Board covered the administrative cost more, they could apply for legacy dollars, for water quality grants, and you wouldn't have the state general fund dollars that are going in there. And for me, that's the question. What's the state role in this? What is the outcome that the state provides? And the outcome has to be more than we've always done it. Because there are plenty of places around the state where watershed districts, watershed management organizations, local units of government are doing similar roles, whether it's flood control or not, but they're not getting that direct state appropriation for administrative costs.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, if I might, I think, you know, I just want to make one point. The state general funds are both for some administrative costs that they share with the locals, but also for the technical work that they use to design these projects and so forth before they're actually constructed. So I think, you know, maybe there's a fine line there, but it's both technical and administrative. Madam Chair, I'll move on if there's more questions on this item.
Madam Chair and Mr. Jaski, I guess knowing a little bit about Area 2, as I used to represent part of that area, and I mean, I do think that they did good work, but reading through this here, you know, the part that offers me some questions is that it said it'd be extremely difficult to, to establish a watershed district because lack of power on the All Medicine Rivers are already have long-standing established watershed districts. And likewise, Redwood Cottonwood Rivers Control Area was formed in 1983 to prohibit the formation of a watershed district as the Joint Powers Board system was favored with local control. And it just, it seems like some steps are taken basically to, you know, make the argument that, well, we can't, you know, tax ourselves or we can't do this because of these other arrangements. And I personally don't think that there is as much complication there as perhaps is exhibited here with getting those watershed districts, you know, the All Medicine and Lack of Power to work together. But then also the idea that this Cottonwood-Redwood Rivers Control Area was formed just to prevent this happening, it seems like that isn't a good enough reason as to why they shouldn't be funding a role many other places around the state are being asked to do on a regular basis.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I think, you know, that's a fair point about the Redwood Cottonwood. I don't, maybe this is written not quite exactly right, but it doesn't prohibit the formation of a water district. I think it's probably right that it was created to substitute for one. I think that's probably what you were describing to me. It's also true that counties do have existing levy authority for water management projects, but very few of them have exercised it as a unique levy option, but a few cases. I don't know of any in the Redwood-Cottonwood River. Although I think, actually, I'm going to take that back. I know that Redwood County just did one project that they used a special levy for. I'd have to go back and look and see exactly what the purpose of it was. I think it was more of a water quality project. These are really about flood control, you know, damage prevention. That's what their mission and purpose was created to be, and they were set up to do that through a large study that was done to determine how to best address those chronic flooding problems in this part of the Minnesota River because of that topography. But I think that I understand your point about the local levy or the local contribution. I think there's more than one way to accomplish that, I guess, and we may want to, if we're going to ask them to consider something, give them a few more options to consider than simply the one that's in statute.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just one question, I mean, two, or maybe something you could respond to. And I know we've had this conversation to a certain extent about, you know, the effects of drainage and tiling and how it's changing hydrology. And I represent Renville County now, and I know it's just across the river from Redwood County, but I know that there's been a huge amount of, you know, agricultural drainage that's been put in. And it seems that, you know, there's not an unwillingness to go in and address the drainage ditch, you know, clean those up to make sure that that whole system is functioning. But when you have all that water impacting, you know, the overall system here, it seems like there's an unwillingness to go and deal with the flood problems, you know, that are potentially created or somewhat impacted because you have so much water moving so quickly at particular points during the year. And maybe if you could comment to that a little bit, because it's to go and say that, you know, these counties are unwilling to tax themselves, you know, to go and maintain the health of the drainage ditches, you know, to move water away, means that I kind of find it that they should almost have to go and deal with the flood problems, you know, with their own local resources, because they're willing to pay for one part that potentially is, you know, creating a greater issue with respect to the flooding.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I agree with you that we have to find ways to do more storage and treatment of water that is coming from drainage systems. There's no question about that. You know, and some of the, you know, maybe much of the water that is flowing through these counties in the Stream Powers area is partly emanating from those sources. So there is opportunity to do that. You're no doubt about that. And we're going to have to find ways to get those drainage authorities, you know, in this case, I think it's mostly counties, but some watershed districts. They're going to need some probably some additional tools to be able to do that, because the current law really prescribes only one purpose for those systems, and that is to remove water. And that still has to happen, but we got to find places to store and treat it as well for flood control, for water quality, for those things. That's a much bigger conversation. I think it goes into the policy arena a good bit, but it does also go into the revenue generation side, because you're right, those ditch systems are managed and maintained with assessments, you know, sort of like a tax or a fee, I guess you can think of it that way, to get rid of the water, but they don't have an equivalent to do the storage and treatment.
The basic question is this a state responsibility? And if it is, if it's just flood control, then why are we not bonding for it? Why are we using general fund dollars? And it does feel like people are getting the advantage of draining water off the land and then wanting somebody else to pay for it. Could I be right about that?
Madam Chair, I think that's been a long, long, long issue. People upstream and people downstream having different ideas about how the water ought to be managed. I think we're going to have that we've had it for a long time, we'll have it for a long time into the future. But I think the equity issue is what you're getting to, you know, about how do we. And we've figured that out in some places, you know, where the utilities have been created to both pay for a contribution and a benefit. You know, there's two different sides to that water equation. I think, as Representative Falk had talked about in the drainage systems, you know, it's kind of a one-sided equation, and we've got to find ways to get more storage and treatment on those systems, whether they're urban or rural.
So Oh, any more questions on this? Senator Tomasonity had to visit with Senator Bach for a few moments, so what I think we're going to do is take a short recess until he comes back. I would expect it's not going to be more than 10 minutes, but there, the next issue that we need to get into is the one about the $450,000 that the Senate doesn't have, so there's no point in talking about it without the Senate here.
Madam Chair, and maybe before we break, I think there were some riders here where there were one or two word differences, and if Mr. Jashke could just get on the record which
that
language they prefer, I think, on R33.
Madam Chair, members, on R33, the language is one word that's been added on the House side on line 70.1. The word enforcement was inserted as contrasted with the Senate. I think I'm catching these all. If I don't, you can remind me. On line 70.4, the word technical was included. That was not included in the Senate side. And on line 70.3, the words matched by non-state funds was included as a component of the Red River Basin Commission appropriation. And all three of those provisions are acceptable to the agency. So we could either take those or not. Either way is fine.
Perhaps while we are on recess, Senator Sparks can contemplate whether he would like to make a motion to take the House language. I mean, it's very small, but it would move us along. So with that, members, we are in a short recess. To the call of the chair, but I'm anticipating about 10 minutes. Senator Sparks, did you have a motion in mind?
Yes, Madam Chair. When Senator Tomasoni was going, I think it was on R33, and I don't know exactly. I think there was two or three word changes that actually Bowser preferred the House language, so I would move those changes.
Okay. I think that it's worth repeating what they are.
We need to have one more.
Oh.
We don't have enough numbers.
Well, technically he's here.
Oh, technically.
For these three words, it's probably okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I will just repeat it. On line 7.1, it's adding the word enforcement. On 7.4, it's adding the word technical. And on line 70.13, it's matched by non-state. Did I get that right, counsel?
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Motion is adopted. And so then I think we need to go to the thing here is that 70, which are 34, 70.31, the House money for transition, and the Senate did not, so we need to have a little discussion about that.
Madam Chair, yes, this is also a governor's recommendation. And I forget it was our number one priority in the budget process this year. And the reason for that is that this funding would allow for policy language that was passed in last year's legislative session and worked on for a couple of years prior to that between the counties, watershed districts, stormwater conservation districts, and to some extent the cities, that allows for them to jointly prepare water management plans and implement them, as opposed to each of them having to do it themselves. And we believe it's really important to get that that new approach, the one watershed, one plan approach, as we call it, off and actionable here in the first year after that policy is passed. And this will, down the road, provide a great deal of efficiency because we'll operate with somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 80 or 90 water management plans rather than a couple of hundred that we now have to review and approve and operate under. And it will also, in my mind, be much more aligned with the work that the PCA is doing on the watershed work that they're doing to assess, to monitor, assess, and work on the TMDLs and the RAPs that are now being pursued. And so, Madam Chair and members, this is something that we do believe is a good idea and a high priority for the agency.
And Madam Chair, I believe we had, Mr. Mueller tells me that we had this in the same language as in the Clean Water Bill.
Yes.
And so I take it the funding is also in the Clean Water Bill.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, I think it's the exact same rider and the same dollar amount is in the Senate Clean Water Bill that was just distributed today.
So we've got some kind of an agreement somewhere, but it's just a matter of how we approach it now.
Then let me put on, ask a question that I will do this. How many of them are going to get done? I mean, what is the time frame? The time frame I know is 10 years, right? How much of it is going to get done? What is the big dollar we are looking at to get the whole job done? I hope you're not telling me it's many multiples of this.
Well, Madam Chair,
we have the same amount of money.
You know, This will be something that will, as you said, take place over, we believe, a 10-year period where we now go from the couple of hundred plans that the county's watersheds and some water districts do to this one watershed approach. This money will not pay for all of that work, but it will pay for the portion that will be matched by the local governments that have their own resources to bring to the equation. We will use this money as incentive grants to local governments to do this one watershed, one plan together. This is anticipated to be a 10-year effort, so you can do the multiplier, I suppose, by 10 years. And I don't know if it'll be the same number. We expect the first years will be largely, you know, voluntary. They will be selected on a pilot basis to get this started, and then we'll go from there and see where the next phase of it takes us.
You're talking about $4.5 million to get move from
$450,000.
How much?
10 years.
Over 10 years. That just seems enormously expensive. Tell me why it's expensive.
Well, Madam Chair, these are...
Add in why we need to do it.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair?
Add in why we need to do it as well as why it's so expensive.
Sure. Madam Chair, this is a new policy that instead of having counties and storm water districts and water districts do their own individual plans, they will be joining forces to do these across those geopolitical boundaries. So they will follow the watershed boundary. They will use a good bit of the data and assessment that work that has been done by the Pollution Control Agency, by the DNR for the biology. But they also have to bring into the equation flooding, water supply, recreation, groundwater. Those pieces also have to be put into these plans to have them be comprehensive. And so that work, you know, doesn't happen automatically. It takes effort to do that. And I shouldn't predict how much it's going to cost over 10 years. I just don't have that information. What we're going to do is use this money to provide competitive grants to those that are interested in taking this on initially. And we will learn from that. And we'll be able to tell you, you know, much more accurately what the costs are going to be over a longer period of time. The only thing I should add, I can't even tell you how many of them will be done because it depends on the scale, right? I mean, if we have, you know, larger areas, more issues, more population, those things become complicators or more costly undertakings, I guess, if you want to think of it that way, because we have to do more assessment. But we're going to do the first year, and we'll let you know in the second and third years how much more it might take.
Are you including groundwater in this?
Madam Chair, yes, it would be included.
Any other questions from members on this? Any other questions on Bowser? Representative Hansen.
And I apologize if I was gone, but did you go over the PRAP evaluation?
We have not. Do you want to?
if Mr. Jashke can describe that.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, on line 71.7 in the House position, there is a $310,000 appropriation to fund a statutory requirement that we do performance evaluations and assistance to local governments that are doing water management. That statute was created in 2007. Initial money was appropriated. What occurred then, of course, shortly thereafter, there were some budget challenges, and in 2009, when this issue was part of a conference committee discussion, there was, in some fashion, a discrepancy between a House and a Senate position, and it was reconciled by requiring that money be sent back from another appropriation to do the balancing. And so that carried forward in a one-time basis, and then, of course, 2 years ago, we were doing budget work in the middle of the summer, and there wasn't an opportunity to be clear about whether this was one-time or continuing, and so it went forward as a continuing obligation for us to pay back to the general fund from another source to work on this requirement. And so this money would be used to basically undo that, I guess we call it an awkward budgeting arrangement, where we're appropriating money for projects under another provision, and then we have to use the return funds from that, if any are available, to run this program. So this would correct that unusual circumstance.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Mr. Jashke, this is language you provided to the House to correct that problem, correct?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it is.
Any other questions for Mr. Jashke? I think as you... since we don't have a target yet, it would be helpful if you, when you come back to visit us, if we had some sort of outcomes or expectations from this $450,000 each year and some timeline that was more reasonable than 10 years, I think it would be helpful to have more definition. It feels so soft that.
Is there any relationship between the paragraph that we talked about earlier between 70.31 and 71.2 and the paragraph at 71.7 and 71.11? I see they both have a 103B, but one says section and the other one says chapter.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the One Watershed, One Plan language on 71.2 refers to all three or four, actually, of the statutes that currently have some connection to watershed management. Each of those are the current statutes that prescribe a plan being written, and this then allows for us to do one plan that covers all four of those. On 71.11, that statutory reference is to a specific section that requires the agency to do this oversight of the performance of the local water management authorities that are creating those plans mentioned above.
I think that's all we have for
politics. No. Ed could come up. We got about 20 minutes max. I know Senator Sparks might be leaving in about 10 minutes and so.
All right. Well, we're going to invite agriculture to come up and visit with us. And we found out what order.
2006.
I think maybe we talked about some of the differences in language first would be helpful. Okay. Probably isn't much. Is it anything more than?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greta Gauthier, Department of Agriculture. I believe you have done all the same and similars except for the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, which is not part of the governor's budget. And then there was a some policy language in the Senate requiring an annual report on the Agri program, which was also not in the governor's budget, and then the differences. And there are some policy differences that that would not have dollar amounts attached to them. However, I didn't realize I was going to be up tonight, so I don't have all their technical people here. But I can handle some of these things.
Well, Madam Chair, I just was questioning, when you say the Agricultural Education Leadership Council, that was on the same list, and they did adopt the
right.
same list. So that's been adopted.
Oh, that's been adopted. That's right.
A five-year extension.
I just thought, sorry, Madam Chair, I apologize.
I just wanted to clarify that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe there was some discussion about going back to that, though, but maybe I misheard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that actually there was some discussion about how long we were going to continue that program, because there were some questions perhaps about the purpose and the role and just the people that are working there, and I know that there's been some staff turnover. And with that turnover, how likely it would be to get grants or other types of the goals and ideas we set forward for them to accomplish actually done and in a timely fashion. So that's one of the things that perhaps we should have a little discussion about it.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Schoenfeld will be able to assist in that discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators. I'm not quite certain what the question is exactly, but I can tell you that the I think the reference was made to the executive director position, which recently resigned. She is, as of today, still in that position, as I understand it, but she'll be leaving in May here. It's my understanding that there's this discussions have gone on to start a search. One of the things that is in the state statute relative to MLC, it's actually a statutory creation, and one of the things that is in there is the fact that the council itself, the board members of the council, are intended to hire the executive director. And there is a second employee that is acting as the acting director at the present time. And so just 2 days ago, Representative Falk mentioned grants. The grants committee met 2 days ago. So the activities that take place with it are still ongoing. And I know that the grants committee met 2 days ago. And so I don't think anything has stopped because of the resignation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Mr. Schoenfeld or Ms. Gauthier. Is there a need to extend this for a period of out to 2018, or should it be something that we should be reviewing more frequently to figure out if it's being done as effectively and efficiently as possible? And I know we've got a lot of things that are being looked at in this bill, but kind of putting things on autopilot is one of the things we're trying to get away from.
Well, Madam Chair, I can only tell you that the extension that has been there, this was started in 1997, and at that time there was a five-year sunset put in so that we reviewed every 5 years. So it has been every 5 years since 1997. I would encourage you to leave it at 5 years because of the fact that as we look for a new executive director, or as the board does, that one of the things I would assume is that people would want to have some certainty about their future, that it was going to be there if they were going to take the job. So I think it's important to give some sense that it will be there. Beyond that, I think also that it has been reviewed by the committee, and there is an annual report that is required in the statute that comes back. That report either be in a written form or directly to the committee, and I think the tradition has been that every year the committee has reviewed the activities of MLC in terms of the Committee on Agriculture. So I think it's something that is an ongoing situation that way.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Schoenfeld, that in private conversation between us, you had mentioned that the board had gone through some strategic planning process and that there's a document on goals and objectives or outcomes. Would you be supportive of maybe just referencing that along with the extension so we have something in the statute that we can measure by over the extension period of time? So 5 years from now, there's a measurement in the statute that whoever's here looking at it can evaluate on?
Well, I'm not sure. Are we Madam Chair or Mr. Chair today? I'm not certain who's chairing the committee today. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative, I think that is probably kind of being done anyway in this annual report. I don't know that you really need to add that. I'm not opposed to the idea of that people would continue to operate off the blueprint, and I'm showing you here what I'm talking about. One of the functions, there are many functions of MLC as far as I'm concerned. One of those functions is to provide coordination between the different agencies that deal with ag education, and that is the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, Department of Agriculture, Department of Education, and so forth. And that was the real reason for its creation, that interagency action. The other function required by law is a grants program for innovative programs in ag education, and that's ongoing. And then one of the other things was that it was supposed to be, the initial concept was that it would act a little bit as a place where people could look at ag education in an ongoing arena and suggest the future and changes and what was needed, and also come back through the report to the legislature to suggest changes to the legislature that might be made. The blueprint that is here was created in 2012, which was part of that kind of philosophical long-range planning part of it. And it does have basically the implementation of this blueprint is what I would expect the board would be going on this coming year. One of the things that I think is unique about this, not unique because you have other legislative commissions that do this, but for instance, Senator Sparks and Representative Poppe serve on this committee at this time. There are a number of governor's appointees, and so I think you have that direct involvement by the legislature that can kind of maintain that. I'm not sure what we would gain, but I mean, I think that people welcome the idea to be reviewed and to be looked at, and I think that it's an outcome-based kind of a situation. So I don't know if there's anything to be gained, but you know, I think this will be done in any case.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I say that I have some reservations about extending it as 5 years just because I want to know what the outcome is here. And Mr. Hagmiller was kind enough to point me to the language here. So we're appropriating $235,000 per biennium. I'm trying to remember, but is there other money that goes into this beyond the state? I mean, I think that's correct, that there is some money that's put into it by different organizations.
Mr. Chairman, they get some private funds that come into it as well. The funds that you're speaking about, the $235,000, is primarily for the grants program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, so do we know how much the private funds are?
Madam Chair, it depends upon what they're able to secure and so forth. It's not a large amount, but I think in some years it's been $20,000 to $30,000 that they've been able to secure privately, but I don't think it's a large amount.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld, for that. And you said it's for grants, so none of that $235 pays for the executive director, the admin, the building space, the...
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Falk, when this was first created, there were funds through the agricultural special that went to the Ed Department as such. in the College of Agriculture. And the College of Agriculture offered to, at that time, to provide housing and space and a number of things to house this. There's no requirement in the statute that says it has to be at the University of Minnesota in that sense, but the University of Minnesota was set up statutorily as the fiscal agent to operate the funds through. And so there is some, it's a little hard for me to tell you exactly a dollar amount in that sense because it's kind of commingled with the Ag Ed department at the university.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess 235, if you divided that to an annual base, it's 117,500 per year. I'm just guesstimating. Maybe you can help enlighten me, but I'm assuming the executive director is probably making at least $50,000 a year, and administrative professionals probably $35,000 a year. And I mean, they're paying for some representation and a few other things, and pretty much you get to a point where there's really not much money, you know, actually for grants.
Madam Chair, as I indicated, I think most of that, the funding for the executive director and the assistant position are through the University of Minnesota. And so this is primarily your grants program.
Okay. And I was mistaken, Mr. Hagemuller, correct me, it was $235,000 per year, so that wouldn't have been $117,000, but it still would be nice to kind of get a detailed accounting of, you know, if we're actually putting this money into projects or if it's just being kind of, you know, paying for process. And I know we want to, you know, make sure that we're spending these dollars appropriately.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, that detailed accounting does come before the board in the fact that every grant that is there is reviewed and it's all laid out there publicly and so forth. So in terms of needing the detailed accounting, I'm certain that can be gotten very easily.
Well, perhaps that could just be sent to the committee and it could be distributed to all members who are interested.
Madam Chair, although I do not work for the MLC board, certainly the members on the board could request that, which would be Representative Poppy and Senator Sparks, and they could easily get it to you. And I could ask for it to be done, and I'll be glad to do so.
Madam Chair, just at least for me, I was just named to the board, and so I've not yet attended a meeting, and I think our first meeting that we'll be attending is in June, so we can certainly ask for that, but I've not yet participated.
But, Madam Chair, I just wanted to indicate that I know those things are all available.
Madam Chair, maybe I could suggest that Representative Poppy would instruct them to request it and get it to us.
Can certainly do that. So I'd be happy to issue that request at this moment.
Madam Chair, I'm not trying to be evasive. I just wanted to indicate, I work for the Minnesota Association of Ag Education. I don't work for MLC.
Right.
And so I don't have quite the direct pipeline that I can speak to it because I helped put it together, but I don't have quite the direct pipeline to the books that probably a board
did
member.
Did you offer to get the stuff? Or did
I will certainly I will certainly go and seek it out, and I know we can get it.
Thank you. I think we've got that taken care of. We have just a few minutes left.
A few minutes, yeah.
So there is a contiguous land provision for R27, and I think there are some folks here who are available to testify about that, and that might be a helpful thing to do right now. Does anybody like to come up and talk about that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you're referring to the Buy the Farm legislation.
Yes, I am. On R27.
Madam Chair, while those folks are coming up, I can just refresh a conferee's memory that this was not part of the governor's budget. I believe it was a bill of Representative Bly and
Senator Dahl, maybe.
Senator, yes, thank you.
I believe it's in Judiciary in the Senate right now.
Madam Chair, are we allowed to pass these out? As that's being passed out, should I continue? Okay. My name is Julie Schwartz. I live in Sibley County, and we are being affected by this CapEx 2020 transmission line. We run a 100-cow dairy and have 575 acres of land that we run. This line is coming through five of our six properties down the middle of one field right now that they've been out destroying the land in the mud. It goes down our driveway right on our property. I'm talking these towers, we call them towers. They're most of ours, well, are 150-plus feet tall. These have arms that stick out 15 feet. Every time we go up and down our driveway, every time we get mail, every time we go out to the field, we have to drive directly under these lines. The same thing when we mix feed for our cows twice a day. We have to either drive directly under these lines or alongside. We have, you know, they talk about safe distance. We don't have a safe distance. This can affect our health. We went out to Wisconsin to talk to a dairy farm 8 to 10 years ago that has cows the same distance as we do, but they have 300 feet of field. Like I said, we have nothing. We are under this or alongside of it. And their farm, they have cow. They went from a 27,000-pound herd, rolling herd average, and I don't know if you understand what that means, but 8 to 10 years ago, that was fantastic herd. I mean, they're probably one of the top, if not the top, in the state. And they dropped to 16,000 pounds. Cows died, calves died, cows aborted. It took 8 to 10 breedings when you hope to get a cow pregnant 2 to 3 times. Every time you breed a cow, it costs money. To this day, they have cows. Well, it's been a year ago since we've talked to them, but they have cows that get burn-like or abscess marks or adhesions on their knees because of the stray voltage. The husband, he can feel the difference in the currents, and when it reaches a certain level, he's okay. When it reaches the next level, he can feel it in his body. When it goes the next level higher, his whole body breaks out in a rash. His wife also has some, and I didn't ask about cancers or things like that, but this affects their health besides, and cows are 10 to 12 times more susceptible to this transmission line. My husband, unfortunately, had a hip replacement. It'll be 3 years ago in June, and he's on a Stryker recall. And I only bring this up because when our doctor asks, how far away is your house, and we told him about 400 feet away, he said that's too close. In CapEx's own paperwork that they send out, it says pacemakers or implantable defibrillators, artificial limbs, screws, pins can be affected. We don't feel we have a choice in staying there. Our farm would be a century farm in about 8 years. Our kids are a part of this. Our son was planning on eventually buying it and living there. It's, like I said, it's going to be a century farm in 8 years, and we just feel we don't have the choice to live there anymore. Another point I'd like to make is when it's been a year now ago, 2012, May 9th, that our easement land was condemned. And at that time, according to our understanding, when we go and try and agree on something, the appraisal goes back to the time the land was condemned. In this case, that means May 9th of 2012. At that time, CapEx said that land was worth $7,000 an acre in our county. We know of land within the last few months that's gone for $10,000 to $12,000 an acre plus. That means to replace our land, we'd have 160 acres. We would have to go to our lender and borrow $500,000 to $1 million just to replace our same land base. Another point I like to bring up is in the last house, some of the last house hearings, CapEx has been bringing up that that they don't want to buy land. We asked them to move the line. We were told there's a 1,000-foot easement. And when we called them and asked them to move it 500 feet, they said, no, we only have a 600-foot easement. We can only move it part. But we're not going to do that because we already paid your neighbor. We asked them, okay, just buy the farm site. They said, no. We said, okay, can we change the property line, run it the length of the 80, and go behind the farm site. They said no. We asked them 40 acres. They said no. We said 80 acres. They said no. We're up to 160 acres of our best quality land with our highest yielding land. And now they're saying that they don't want to buy land, and we don't want to sell our land, but we only have one election with Buy the Farm. And if they don't accept that election, then we're out. We have no other option. You get the one election and that's it. So if we would elect it that we wanted to sell the farm site and they said no, that's it. We don't have any option. It just seems, one other thing I want to briefly talk about is it seems to be coming up about the Supreme Court hearing that's in the courts. We won't get a decision until August at the earliest, and that only deals with two issues. This bill takes care of clarifying Buy the Farm law. The intent of the law, that's what this bill is for, to carry through with the intent of the law, what the law was meant to do, and that's why we need this bill. If we don't get this, and it's just on the Supreme Court ruling, and say they do favor us, and it goes in our decision, there's still all these other things that CapEx can come back or try and find loopholes and come back to us and keep delaying. There's people for over 2 years that thought they had agreement and haven't seen a penny. Like I said, we've been looking for over 2 years to find another dairy farm. Where dairy farms just aren't out there. As we handed out Senator Gene Merriam, he was one of the senators, one of the chief authors on this bill when it was passed in the 70s, and he testified through this letter at the Senate Energy Committee. So I thought he explained it very well, and he's very in support of this. If you have any questions, otherwise, I truly thank you for listening and considering this. This is so important to so many people throughout our state. It's not just the few of us that are coming. There's people throughout our whole state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we? I see other testifiers before
us. I would try to be brief. Madam Chair, Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kirk Schnitker. I'm an attorney, and I practice in the area of eminent domain law, and I've had a lot of experience in some of these CapEx takings. Essentially, it's hard for me to speak much clearer than Ms. Schwartz as to some of the issues. But essentially, all this law does is these amendments is it clarifies the Buy the Farm legislation and policy that this legislature established in 1976. That was a result of many of the problems that the state saw with some of the power lines at that time. Throughout much of the litigation that's been going on, one of the major arguments that we've been seeing on the part of the utilities has been that the law is doesn't say certain things, therefore certain compliances with Chapter 117 don't have to be complied with. And in many respects, it doesn't. In two district court decisions, the court have said, well, it's not exactly clear, but it's pretty implied in there. Therefore, the courts have said, no, we think that these rights and full Chapter 117 rights ought to apply. Well, they went to the court of those cases were appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals on a split decision, 2-1, overruled the district court decision, and now the Supreme Court's going to deal with the matter. But the point of the matter is all we're trying to do is get the law clarified. If they don't think that it applies, and they say that it doesn't directly make it clear what the policy of the legislature is, that's the intent of this law, to say that anybody that's impacted by a buy-the-farm taking is going to be afforded the same rights that anybody else is involved in any kind of a taking involving a highway or an airport or a park project or anything like that. The Supreme Court matter is only dealing with a couple of small issues, and this makes it clear and applies the same thing to everybody else. The litigation that's been going on has been very protracted. They've made it clear if we don't have this law, we'll have litigation in a whole bunch of other areas in the future, and so it does bring some clarity to these and some peace to these people's lives. Some of these takings have been going on for years already, and these people just suffering a tremendous hardship for a project that's meant for the public as a whole. One of the overall issues with this matter is the CapEx doesn't want to have to buy these farms, and we understand that to some degree, and they challenge a good number of the elections that these landowners have taken. They've said, you know, we don't want to sell our farm, but we don't want to live with these high voltage power lines across our property. But the reality is the expenses that they're going to incur are probably nominal in the sense that they're going to take the property and the law says that they must resell it anyway. So they're going to be reselling these properties, and we think that the cost to the utilities and passed on eventually to the consumers is going to be nominal. This matter is about people and how it's affecting lives, and a project, as I said, was intended for the public as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jackie Odenthal. I, too, am a farmer. I've been my husband and I started over 22 years ago due to a contaminated well from waste management. So we got out of that situation. We went to the next situation 22 years ago to start our family farm over again so our kids could take it. We have 4,000 head nursery of pigs. The line is 300 feet from our barn. Also, we have 205 acres. This line is just not on one side of our farm. It is on two sides. It comes up the west side, and it goes on the north side. We are surrounded by it. It'll be on 24/7. When they first came in, they said that they were only going to put up one line. They put up two lines. And who knows what else will be coming. I don't want to wait around to see. I want to buy the farm. And that's why we went with it. It was a very, very hard decision to do. We have beef cattle, too, and we raise soybeans and corn. Like Julie said, they've been out constructing. I live 3 miles west of you, and just down to the corner line, and then you can see me, and then over. And I lost my train of thought. But anyways, it's not just our line. We're Brookings, South Dakota, to Hampton, and from Hampton down to Rochester through Wisconsin. And also there is 4 other lines in this state. It's not just ours. There's almost 800 miles of line in this state that affects Minnesotans. I think this buy the farm needs clarity, so I would like the intent to be clarified. And I hope you support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Yes, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps it's not so much a question, more of a comment, too. And I know we've heard this piece of legislation or this bill in numerous committees. And the nominal cost of the utilities is really, you know, quite, I would say, a pittance. But the impact to these, you know, individuals is quite huge. The other thing, too, is we did actually get on the record, too, that the utility, one of the persons that was, you know, representing capital or CapEx, did admit that there would be a negative impact in the valuation of the properties, you know, where a line is proposed to be constructed. And so even with their own testimony presented before at least the House of Representatives, you know, they acknowledged that there would be negative valuation impacts. Up until that point, I'm not certain if they had been willing to admit that before on the record, but that was one of the things that was brought forward. And so I do hope that we take these folks' concerns seriously, because it is a truly difficult and untenable position that they've been put in, because just the difficulty of finding similar farmland or a similar area to go and start an operation, specifically in the agricultural economic climate that we're faced with today, it really is an undue burden on these folks, and I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schnickner, maybe you'd be the best to answer this, but I think it was Mrs. Schwartz that indicated two of the issues are part of what's being at the Supreme Court. The other issues, could you just give us, for the members here, could you just give us a quick rundown of those issues that maybe the two that are at the court, but then the others that aren't at the court that you're asking for clarity on?
That's a good question. The Madam Chair, Chairman, members of the committee, the two issues at the Supreme Court, now we're at the Court of Appeals, are the issues of relocation and minimum compensation. Those are matters that are in statute in Minnesota. And as I said, the two district court decisions in Wright County and Stearns County made the decision that these people were eligible, and then on a 2-1 vote, it was overturned at the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court's going to deal with that. But the balance of Chapter 117 is is you know, a couple hundred pages in a lot of statutes that apply to appraisals and process and rights and timing and fees and costs and commissioners and how things are valued, and all of those things have to be established as well. There's a whole package of statutory rights that are afforded to folks, and what we're running into in the wall in those things is they're saying, well, if the law doesn't say we have to appraise it, then we don't have to appraise it. We've had folks in some cases that have elected, and CapEx has not challenged the election, and we've said, okay, well, then have an appraisal done now. And they've said, well, you get an appraisal done. And we say, well, no, the Chapter 117 rules say that you need to have the property appraised. And they refuse to do that, and we go on for years at a stalemate like that, and they finally say, well, we don't have to have an appraisal because the law doesn't specifically lay out that process. That's all this law does, is it just clarifies that all of those normal procedural condemnation rights that are afforded to any other person in Chapter 117, which is the eminent domain provisions of the law as far as the right to take property, are applied equally to all those that that have their property taken.
Other questions, Representative? Any other members? Thank you for...
Thank you for your time.
People need to hear... opposed, do you have time to do that, or are you already?
Are there people here who are opposed? Or?
Well, are there utilities here who believe that they should not be paying the bill? Apparently not. Oh, well,
there's somebody.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Pierce with Xcel Energy, and I am certainly not our subject matter expert on this issue. Obviously, we Xcel Energy works with the other utilities in the CapEx group to on this particular issue, and depending on the line, each utility has different responsibilities around the property acquisition and the landowner conversations. I can try to address questions at a high level. I certainly can talk a little bit about some of our general concerns as they've been talked about in previous committees, in particular as Representative Falk talked about in the House of Representatives. But glad to, you know, address whatever questions I can or share some of the concerns that utilities have had or have raised in the previous conversations.
I think one of the basic numbers that are important for us to understand is while these lines go over many properties, many, many properties, very few are impacted as severely as those who have testified. So most people choose not to elect to the buy a farm. Am I right about that?
Madam Chair, I've talked to a number of our folks who work directly with the landowners, and depending on the line, I think that's generally a true statement. Most property owners do not make the election, but I think it depends on where the which line we're talking about, and obviously the degree of agricultural property that the line is touching.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Falk and then Senator Westbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to the testifier, I just trying to get some things clarified here, because when a person makes a buy the farm election, or essentially, or when an easement's taken, they're given a one-time payment, you know, or, you know, if they choose to stay on the property but they get the easement payment, it's a one-time payment, a one-time lump sum. For how long does the utility get to recover or recover from ratepayers the asset value of that line when it's in the asset base of the utility?
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I'm not sure I'm the best person to talk to or explain the rate case process. Obviously, you know, each investor-owned utility has a rate base, and to the extent that a line is built and included in the rate base, Depending on the depreciation schedule of that line, you know, the utility will keep that in the rate base for a number of years, no question.
So, you know, a typical depreciation schedule would be, what, 40 years longer for some of these long-lived assets?
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, on a transmission line, I don't know off the top of my head what the depreciation schedule is.
Would you wager a guess? It's probably somewhat fairly long-lived.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, again, I just don't know.
Well, I think, you know, having a little bit of knowledge in the subject matter, the kind of the issue and one of the, I would say, extremely unfair aspects of this is, you know, you're giving a one-time lump sum payment to the landowner who's, you know, forever having their land impacted, yet the utility gets to go and earn a rate of return allowable by the PUC. In this Xcel's case, it's about a little over 10% each and every year on that asset when it's put inside their rate base. When it's put in their asset base, and so they're able to earn return on that, and you know, there is an incentive to go and put as many assets as possible into the rate base because that's where the utility gets most of its profit from. It's not really on the sales of electricity, and hopefully our PUC does a good job in determining if those assets are, you know, justified and used and useful. But just so people understand too, you know, the person losing their land or having the negative impact, one-time payment, hope it's fair. Utility gets to go and extract dollars out of ratepayers and earn a rate of return on that asset for the entirety of its useful life.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, again, I'm not qualified to talk about the details of utility rate making, and I'm not sure that's of interest to the committee. I know the section of law, there is a subdivision that gives the owner an election to take payments over a period of time with 8% annual interest. So there are some caveats built into the law that I think are unique to the situation. The point I guess we would like to make is, you know, as the previous testifiers have talked about, building transmission, building power plants, pretty much everything we do tends to negatively impact somebody. That's one of the challenges of our business. And so we really do strive to find that appropriate balance. And in the case of some of the folks that you've heard from, I think the issue at hand is not so much about the election, is about the some of the technical details around it. So, for example, we touched a little bit on some of the issues that the Supreme Court is dealing with now around minimum compensation and relocation benefits. Those are real issues for the people impacted, and we're obviously waiting to see what the court has to say. There is another group of people that we encounter as well, folks that don't necessarily live on the land. There's not dwellings on the property, and, you know, that's a little different class of folks, and those tend to be some of the elections that get challenged. And so anytime you cast a wide net like this, certainly it is difficult to try to find that right balance about what is fair.
Well, I think one of the key things was stated there is a negative impact. I mean, we acknowledge that there's a negative impact. Nobody wants to have a super high voltage transmission line going through their property. I mean, I think all of us could agree to that. But the issue here is, you know, once we establish that there is a negative impact, are you going to, you know, treat people fairly, or are you going to go and lowball them? And, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, this is an incredibly expensive asset that's going to go into your asset base that you're going to be able to extract a rate of return from all the ratepayers for the lifetime of that asset. I mean, it's the amount of money that will be generated for the profitability of the shareholders of the investor-owned utility is immense. And to go and, you know, to not treat people fairly when you know full well that you're causing them a negative impact, irrespective of whether or not there's a dwelling there, I mean, it's a person's property. And for whatever, you know, reasons, we as society have allowed, you know, certain instances of eminent domain for different types of public purposes, but we typically at least force those actions, you know, when those actions occur, that the affected parties be treated fairly. And I don't understand the unwillingness to go and treat others as you would like to be treated.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Falk, you know, you've certainly keyed in on the issue, which is fairness. And, you know, again, it's hard to, you know, I sympathize with the previous testifiers and the impact that these issues have on them. You know, Minnesota does have the Buy the Farm law as a result of the transmission that was built in the 1970s. To my knowledge, we're the only state that has that. The utility building a 200 kW line or that size of line, we're the only group that can be compelled to expand the taking. If it were a different situation, it would be the easement, and the owner, property owner, wouldn't have the ability to force the utility to expand the taking. So I think Minnesota policymakers have done, have kind of wrestled with this issue and have come up with a solution that certainly is unique in the United States in terms of forcing the utility to expand the taking. And I think the added issue about fairness gets into minimum compensation relocation benefits. And I think that's where we're at in our conversation, and I think that's where we're at with the Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, I do think we are unique in that sense, and that's good because we treat people fairly. I mean, perhaps to go and, you know, maybe remove the profit motive from this, we just go and make these non-rate recoverable expenses then. I mean, if that's what we're going to talk, I mean, if that's the nature of it, then, you know, perhaps the utility shareholder shouldn't be able to earn that, you know, rate of return on those assets because of the impact to cost other people. I mean, if it's going to be a negative impact to one party, perhaps, you know, there shouldn't be the positive impact to the other.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I'm not sure I would classify it as a positive impact for the utility. Certainly, we've talked a little bit about, and I think, Representative Falk, you mentioned it, when the utility tries to resell the property, if there's a decline in value, that's certainly not a benefit to the utility. I guess, you know, more than anything, we count on the Public Utilities Commission in terms of rate regulation to determine fairness and what's in the public interest. And I guess this conversation is something that, you know, we do go through that process, and I think we do put our trust in the commission that they look at the routing and the siting process and all of the things that are involved with building transmission, which has been about a 6 to 7 year process. And we have to count on the fact that the Public Utilities Commission does hold a fair process and does hold utilities accountable for what we're doing and does regulate both how the work is done as well as the earnings around it. And I'm not sure that we want to continue to dive into as much as how utilities are regulated and question the whole PUC process as much as trying to move this conversation forward and figure out what type of solution is available to the folks that testified earlier and the situation they're in.
Just to be clear, I wasn't talking about, you know, the making the profit on the selling of land after you've condemned it or bought the whole entire farm. I'm just saying that perhaps, you know, these lines, they shouldn't, you know, perhaps utility shouldn't be able to earn its rate of return either at the high level that it's currently allowed or maybe at this level, because it is kind of unfair because, you know, utility gets to go and put the line on somebody's property and it's there for its entirety and they earn money off of it each and every year it's in operation.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
Senator Westrum. I'll try to be quick, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I guess I'd be interested in the reaction from the prior testimony. Sounds like maybe you see there's some issues that could be clarified and resolved, or are none of these issues worth resolving? We heard a little about just the clarity of an appraisal and a timeline. Can you react to that? What issues might there be some more agreement on, or do you think it's clear?
Madam Chair, Chairman, Senator Westrum, the clarity that we're adding to this is fairly simple. It's as if there's a taking, it's the entire Chapter 117 would apply and all those same rights that are afforded. But really, the only difference between this and any other kind of a taking is essentially you have the buy the farm election, and somebody elects, they compel the utility to take the entire farm, and Representative Falk spoke well to that. There's a concept in law that individuals who are impacted by taking should not suffer the burden for projects that are intended for the public as a whole. And that's kind of, you know, in this kind of a case, I understand that the utilities don't want to buy this entire farm, but on the other hand, the landowners and the legislature has made this public policy decision three decades ago that these folks ought to have the option of having the utilities simply buy the property and then resell that parcel back. And they can sell it to the public, and it puts that position on the utilities that they can turn around and do that. I would disagree with the testifier in the sense that this is not completely outside of the purview of what happens in the law and takings anyway. Oftentimes you get situations where the government, you get takings in cases when there's such an incredible amount of damage or severe damages, the government is compelled to take the entire property anyway. So it's not like this is just completely a nuance just to these cases. The legislature back in the day in 1976 simply said, in these cases, given the impact of a power line utility, high voltage and certain high voltage power line utilities, we're not talking about small utilities that are impacted in small, let's say, rural utilities, but these large high voltage utilities, power lines, when the impact is so great, they take the entire property and sell it. Those people who wish to buy it, they buy it with the understanding that they get that utility. Many of these cases, they're not going to be able to farm near it. And that's the essential issue with many of these landowners. They can't they don't want to live next to these power lines. They can't operate their farm operations, so they have that option. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Pearson, I'm interested in just your reaction as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, you know, again, I'm not probably the best person to speak on behalf of all of our, you know, I'm not as close to the issue as Mr. Schnitker is or some of our folks who work in the land rights area. I can share with you, you know, a number of, you know, data points. Our Bemidji-Grand Rapids line, for example, we crossed 70 miles in three counties and we had eight people who chose the election. You know, there are a lot of people who do decide to stay, do continue to farm the same property that they've always farmed. You know, this is where it gets tricky, is we run into the majority of our property owners that we're impacting, look at that, they look at the easement, they work with the payment, we get the values figured out, the payments made, and they go on with their lives just as they have prior to the line being there. Other people, as the previous testifiers indicated, you know, they look at this situation and their situation's different and they come to a very different conclusion and they need to move on. And, you know, we respect that. I think the law does do a good job in asking or compelling the utility to buy that. My understanding is the election is not in question as much as some of the timing issues and the value issue and the minimum comp and the relocation benefits. Those things that are before the court are really the key issues on why we haven't been able to reach a conclusion on some of these cases.
Next.
Chair, we maybe have to talk about this more, or maybe we need more testifying later on, but for tonight, I have to go.
I know there's a party tonight.
And I'm thinking that maybe if our schedules allow, we can maybe get back together tomorrow around 3.
It will probably be 3 or a little bit later.
Okay.
The house is.
I think we'll have a long day on the floor tomorrow also. So we'll see if we can fit things in. And maybe we can do the conference committee while sessions are going on if that's possible. So
I think we'll try to work on that. Board. Folks, as scheduling purposes, I think we should perhaps we should. I think we finished Bowser. We've started on agriculture. We should finish agriculture and do PCA.
Sure.
So at least we'd have the right staff here. That suit everybody? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And weekend plans?
Get the chair.
I think we are going to have to meet, but it depends if we get a lot of work done tomorrow night and we work late into the evening and get through a huge amount, then maybe we wouldn't have to.
Or if, like, you guys don't want to and you tell the chair you don't want to meet, then
you don't have to. We promise a lot of work on Monday.
Madam Chair, if there were targets, you know, if the Senate could encourage their leadership to set the targets before the weekend, that would be really helpful.
That's a pay grade thing here.
Yeah, that's a pay grade. But I do have the sense that if we got through a ton of work and we could do it in one evening, if we worked the whole evening, we could avoid the weekend. But I'm not sure we can do that. I honestly don't know. We'll make that choice tomorrow. Okay? And with that, thanks, members, for doing all the good work.